From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. When Utah legislators passed a law demanding the federal government hand over 30-plus million acres of public land to the state, they were taking a risk. First, of course, was did they have the legal right to get the land? They figured they did. The bigger question was, could the state afford to manage it or even make money off the land? Last week, an exhaustive 700-page report gave them some hope. The report suggested under the right conditions, Utah actually could make a decent profit if they could get the feds to hand over the land. Others are interpreting the report differently, of course. They say there are just too many factors that would have to fall into place for it to work out for the state. So we'll talk about the report today and the feasibility of this proposal to make a large chunk of federal land state land after the news.
Hi, this is Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. Our online audio and podcasts are made possible by KUER and its listeners. If you like Radio West, help us make it happen. Become a sustaining member of KUER for as little as $5 a month. You can do that online at KUER.org. And thanks.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. So it's been 2 years now since Utah lawmakers passed a law demanding the federal government hand over some public land to the state. They didn't want the national parks. They didn't want most of the monuments. They didn't want control over military bases or Indian reservations. What they wanted was the land that could make money for the state. More than 31 million acres of Bureau of Land Management and National Forest Service land. Now, critics of the idea have pointed out that it wasn't legal to make such a demand in the first place, but they also said it wasn't feasible financially for the state to manage the land. And then came a report last week, an exhaustive 700-plus page report from researchers at three of Utah's public universities that suggested Utah could afford to manage the land. And in fact, under the right conditions, it might be able to make a tidy profit. Now, others see the report differently. They say there are just too many factors that would have to be in place for it to work out for the state. And besides, it doesn't work legally. It doesn't work environmentally. So today in the program, we're going to talk about this report and about the idea itself to transfer, though that's a loaded word, federal land back to the state. We're hoping to hear from you today, your own opinions about all of this. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Brian Maffley is joining us. He covers public lands and the environment for the Salt Lake Tribune. He's been covering this story as well. And Brian, welcome back. Thanks for being with us.
Yeah, hey, thanks, Doug.
Well, so set this up for us, if you would. Give us a sense of how it is we got here. I guess I did a basic setup 2 years ago. Lawmakers passed this law.
Sure.
Now, when they did, did it seem like a message bill, like it was one of those things that was feasible or not? I mean, because it didn't seem likely to a lot of people at the time.
Well,
a lot of people kind of laughed it off.
Yeah, I think it still seems unlikely to a lot of people. The bill is HB 148 and was passed 2.5 years ago now.
Yeah.
And I think back then maybe it was thought of as a message bill because I don't think many people thought that the federal government would just willingly hand over that much land all at one fell swoop like that. And here it is. The deadline is 20 days away.
Right.
Clearly that transfer of land is not going to happen on December 31st as envisioned by the law. So in the interim, we've had 2.5 years now to think about it as a state. We're doing a lot of our deliberations now, I guess, after the bill was enacted. And one of this important studies was done over the last couple of years. Three universities, economic researchers, have put their heads together and put out this 700-plus page report. It was just released a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How surprising were the findings to people? I mean, I think it depends on your perspective,
yeah,
how you read it, for sure, and we'll go through all of that. But I think the initial take was, look, under the right conditions, this could work. And I think it seemed to surprise a lot of people.
Yeah, well, there's under those right conditions are those key into, let's talk about those conditions.
Yeah.
Price of natural gas and oil being high and stable. And that's kind of an oxymoron, really. I mean, the prices of those go up and down, as we're seeing with oil prices right today.
Yeah.
That also dependent on the royalty being charged going up from 12.5% to 6 2/3%, 16 2/3%.
Back up to the natural. I want to stay with the gas thing for a moment, just because according to the model.
Yeah.
Let's talk about what you mean by if they remain stable, which seems dicey, but let's just say, I mean, the prices on that high end of their model have to be at least $92 a barrel
for oil.
For oil to be able, for Utah to be able to make a profit off of these lands.
Well, there's other factors there as well.
Yeah,
the royalty rate is a factor. Currently, the feds charge 12.5%. The state of Utah and its state trust lands is 16 2/3%. So we have a rationale for raising that royalty rate. I'm sure the oil companies wouldn't be too psyched about that. The other one is that the feds would agree to hand over the royalties, 100% of the royalties, of currently producing wells and leases. Right now, they already give the state half of those royalties. And so
they'd have to give them the other 50%.
The other 50%.
Why would they do that?
That's a good question. Why would they do that? These are contracts that were negotiated when the people of the United States own these mineral wealth. So it's questionable whether they would agree to do that. The other big question, obviously, is the prices, and then this royalty. Those are the three key factors. There are probably some other lesser factors that this model looked at. So if these stars align beautifully and stay aligned, the state will stand to make hundreds of millions of dollars. If these conditions don't play out the way they expected, there's a potential to lose a lot of money. Now, a lot of critics have pointed out, you know, the state of Utah is already getting half the royalties from those federal mineral leases. Last year, that amounted to $138 million or so. And they feel that it's not fair to count that money toward the money that the state's going to make once the transfer is accomplished, because they get that money regardless.
Anyway, yeah.
So, and right now, that money is spent on all sorts of things that have very little to do with managing the public lands. So what these economists did was they looked at how much the federal government spends to manage these 31 million acres. And then added the so-called PILT payments on top of that. Those are what the federal government pays the counties. It stands for payments in lieu of taxes. That all added up to about $280 million in recent years, give or take. So what was surprising, I think, to a lot of people was just when you, and then they looked at the revenue, and that's where I think some of the surprises came in. So much of the revenue stream is dominated by oil and gas production. That's 2/3, or no, more like 3/4 of all that money.
Wasn't it 83%?
I think it depends on how you calculate.
Okay.
It's a lot. Yeah, it's a lot. It's confusing because the BLM manages oil and gas off of national forest land. So however you jigger the numbers, it could be 83, but it is in the tune of a few hundred million and in recent years. But these have been boom years. We've had incredible growth in oil production, very strong prices until recently. You know, if we were going to base what happens in the future on what's happened in the past, it could look pretty good.
Yeah.
Things are going to be changing. And, the other key assumption condition that was met was increasing oil and gas production as well.
I wanted to ask you about that just in terms of a motivator for lawmakers.
Yeah.
This seems like a big one. The idea that the federal government has been decreasing its interest in making money off of federal land, and that equation is shifting in terms of development from the oil and gas industry to private development.
Yeah, there has been some talk about that. I think it's the truth might be a little bit more mixed. There is today in Utah, most of the oil and gas in the state comes off of federal and tribal leases. And the volume of that is growing. However, there's greater growth occurring on state and private lands, and that's one of the complaints some of these county commissioners have raised. Is gee, it looks like we're pushing oil and gas production off the public lands onto the private lands. But the fact is, there's plenty of growth in production on the on the federal lands as well. It's just not as rapid as what's going on elsewhere.
So when you're talking about other factors that come into play in this story, I wanted to ask you about wildfires, because this is a significant one. That a lot of critics have say that it's the amount of money that it could take. I mean, you know, we're in an era of climate change, and California is obviously an example. Well, we have our own wildfires here that we have to deal with. So talk about this as a factor, because a lot of people are saying you need to plug this into the equation.
You really
as well.
Do, because those expenses are extraordinary, but they're also not very constant. You know, I mean, one year your firefighting costs will be huge, like in Utah in 2012. Extremely huge. 2013, 2014, you know, those are fairly tame fire years. And when those economists looked at this question, they also threw in the part of these other fire management concerns that don't have to do with fire suppression, but managing the lands to reduce the possibility of catastrophic wildfire. And they're figuring, you know, 50 to 80 million is required to meet those needs. And who's going to pay for that? Well, that's got to come out of the revenue that's generated off these lands. And what this report really pointed out was it's going to be oil and gas revenue that's going to pay the bills. The fees coming off of grazing, they're almost insignificant. They barely register, maybe $1 million.
$1 million a year?
Yeah.
That the feds make off of grazing fees?
Yeah. It doesn't even come close to paying for the program. And then timber seems...
So under that scenario, Brian, you could get in a situation where state officials are raising fees for some of the constituencies that might be, in fact, supporting this idea, raising grazing fees and other fees. Royalties may have to go up if the state's going to try to keep making money. That is a question that's come up.
Yeah, our ox is going to get gored here, right? Well, I've talked to ranchers and rural county commissioners about that, and they would be just as pleased to pay more for their grazing privileges if they had the feds out of the picture. It's worth it to them to pay a lot more. And as you can see, I mean, if they're only paying $1 million or $2 million a year as an industry, wow, there's plenty of growth there that won't really put anybody out of business.
What was the conversation like? What has it been like between lawmakers and some of these economic researchers in terms of the timber industry in the state?
That was an interesting one. It came up on December 3rd when the economists presented their findings to this so-called Commission on the Stewardship for Public Lands. And they got questioned fairly aggressively about...
Ken Ivory in particular, state lawmaker.
I can't remember, it was Mike Noel.
Noel, forgive me. That's right.
And I had to go back and listen to some of the things that were said. I wasn't in the room that day. But they were a little bit concerned that the economists weren't very bullish on timber. In the past, we have seen a fairly robust industry in Utah, maybe 30 lumber mills they keep talking about back in the 80s. That was a different time, however. And these economists, when I've talked to them, I talked to John Downen for the University of Utah about this. And his feeling when I read that report on timber was we don't really have a good handle of how much merchantable timber is in our national forest. It hasn't been inventoried in over 20 years.
Wow.
A lot of it's on roadless land. And it's not particularly accessible. So to get at that timber means building roads, which, of course, under the current regime is not really allowed under the roadless rule. And it costs money to do that. And so the feeling was that reviving the timber industry here would require some sizable subsidies. We don't even have the infrastructure to process this lumber anymore because these mills have closed down. There's only three or four left. One of them just burned down a few weeks ago in Duchesne County.
Yeah.
So we just don't have the means to process that wood. And I think, you know, Representative Noel and others were really hopeful that we would see a resurgence in that industry. It's an industry that is seen as a green one and providing rural communities great jobs. But I got the feeling from reading that report, timber's not coming back, even if you took all the federal red tape out of there.
Let me ask you about that. That red tape raises this question of what happens if there's a, whatever word you want to use, a transfer of this land to the state.
Yeah.
What happens to NEPA requirements? What happens to the Clean Air Act? What happens to the Endangered Species Act?
Those are such important questions, and like, this is a good time to have a lawyer in the room. But my take on it is those laws are no longer controlling on those lands. You know, National Environmental Policy Act, Archaeological Resources Protection Act, FLIPMA, you know, the I don't even know what it stands for, but the law that created the BLM in 1976, or gave it its mission, its multiple-use mission, the law governing the national forests. There's just so many of them. I can't keep track of them all. Endangered Species Act. These laws don't fully apply to non-federal lands. So these requirements for public disclosure of environmental impacts, protecting these resources and imperiled species that a lot of people in other parts of the country think are very important. But maybe those values aren't so important to the folks in Utah who would like to, you know, not have to get too worried about protecting an ancient archaeological site you can barely see. It's a big issue down in San Juan County right
or
now.
Or a snail. Or a snail
that no one cares about or a little tiger beetle, whatever.
It raises the question of what happens then to public comment. That wouldn't really be a factor, certainly if you didn't have the same sort of federal regulations.
It does seem like that, but Utah does have its laws,
sure.
Its counterpart laws, but they're not as complicated, you know, and it will be easier to do development on these state-owned public lands. And the economists kind of talk about that. That's why they are predicting an increase in oil and gas production. I don't know if they're predicting it, but they're
because
modeling
less regulation.
Less regulation to get in the way of production from those lands. However, I think when you look at history, it's like what really drives this? I think it's the price of natural gas and oil. I mean, we see a lot less interest in natural gas drilling these days because the prices have been soft for the last 3 or 4 years. Where we have been seeing the interest is in oil, and that might change. It would be really interesting to see what kind of drilling pressure happens over the next year or two while these prices, unless, of course, the prices rebound. But I'm not expecting that. You know?
One of the things you've raised, which could be a concern for some anyway, is that under this new scenario, where you have state law applying, not federal law, that county commissioners could be more influential in the process.
I think that's very much their hope. Is we hear that from our state leaders all the time, is that we need to give more trust and influence to those who work on the land or who live around it. So, but, you know, empowering county commissions is very much one of the goals here. And we will see we don't know if this is going to happen. We would see a great deal more influence on the part of the county leaders in how those national forests and BLM lands are administered.
Let me ask you about some of the legal questions here at play. I mean, you know, I think for a lot of people it seemed kind of a moot point. Why talk about the economic impacts here? Because it seems not even possible legally.
Yeah, it truly is an academic exercise, I guess, in the minds of some. I hear that a lot. I think we need to go into this with our eyes open. That's why I think this was a justifiable expenditure of public money. I think we should have done it first. I mean, Idaho just completed their economic analysis. Because
they had a different conclusion, though.
A much different conclusion. And they did it out in front of whether to pass the law or not. You know, obviously other states are very interested in what Utah's doing. That's why this study, I think, is important, not just for Utah, but for the entire West. Idaho is interesting, where they were predicting, huge shortfalls if that state manages their federal lands. But it's interesting to note that they just don't have the energy resources that the other Western states, particularly Colorado and New Mexico, have. So that might be why it's not penciling out as well for that state. Well, back to your question, this is such a radical change with huge repercussions. We need to do it with complete information. This study is an attempt to provide that information. Now, at this most recent Commission on Stewardship of Public Lands meeting, they did try to figure out, what's our next step? We need some legal advice. So they voted to authorize the state to find some outside counsel who specializes in this kind of law to advise them legally. What's the strategy here for accomplishing this goal? Maybe it's a lawsuit. A lot of people think that's a non-starter. So that they're in the process of figuring out the legal strategy now.
Brian, stay with us. Brian Maffley is with us. He covers public lands and the environment for the Salt Lake Tribune. He's been covering this particular story. We're hoping to hear from you if you have your own reaction to this report or the issue itself. 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take a break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the effort of Utah lawmakers to see if they can get the federal government to transfer public land to the state. Now, set aside the significant legal questions for just a moment, which we'll talk about, but lawmakers are have been trying to figure out what if they could do this. And by now, you've heard of the economic report that was released a few weeks ago, which said, depending on your perspective, Utah could, in fact, afford to manage the public land under certain conditions. Joining us now on the program is Carl Graham. He's the director of the Sutherland Institute's Coalition for Self-Government in the West. And welcome back. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
So everyone thought it was such a pie-in-the-sky scheme or concept. Couldn't be done legally, which we'll get to, but I want to get you to react to the study itself. Were you at all surprised at the fact that under certain conditions that was feasible for this
to
happen?
No, we've done some preliminary research and we've got some more studies. They're going to be coming out fairly soon on other states other than Utah that does a similar, although nowhere near as exhaustive, but a similar type of economic analysis. And where we're finding is that at the top level, the numbers do pencil out pretty well, certainly well enough to merit further study. And that's what any state who's going to do this, I agree with your previous guest, one of the first things that has to happen is you've got to do something at this level to really see if the numbers even pencil out.
And do some modeling and see if it plays out.
Exactly.
Now, of course, you're hearing critics are saying, I think this was how Brian put it, stars really do have to align in a certain way. And the chances of you getting stability in the world oil markets enough for you to rely on certain things is taking a bit of a risk.
I would disagree with the premise of that a little bit. The stars have to align, but there's a lot of wiggle room in that alignment or in the movement of those stars. Oil prices, the prices they modeled were $92 and $62. That's a lot of wiggle room, and it even does, under some assumptions, pencil out at $62 over time, not immediately, but over time.
So even if it dropped low.
Yeah, and it's
What are the prices today?
I don't know the exact, but it's probably around $60.
Yeah.
$60 or $70.
I was going to say, could Utah today make money?
It would go out to with 100% royalty, which is another assumption we can talk about.
Yeah, that's a big assumption, but keep going.
It is. But it goes out to about 2017 or 18 is where you start turning a profit on those lands under all the assumptions that they used.
But you're just, it seems like what you're saying is, all right, we've got a layout of these models, but it's time for us to see if we can do this in a way that's better. And I wanted to go through a couple of things with you about that. One is the idea of regulation. Now, a frightening prospect that you strip out certain regulations, at least for environmental factors. For you, I'm guessing your sense is that industry is overburdened with regulation, and this is something that could be much more efficient.
I don't even really have to go there. I have more confidence confidence in Utahns to do the regulation properly in a balanced way so that you have responsible development, but at the same time, you enjoy the reasons that people live in Utah. Utah has environmental regulations. If they need to be strengthened to get to look more like NEPA, then they can be strengthened. And that decision can be made by Utahns, not by somebody in Washington, D.C. The Endangered Species Act isn't really a player because it applies both to federal and private lands. But there are others, antiquities, things like that. If Utah's regulations are not strong enough, then it's a very valid point that Utahns should make that move to make them stronger. If they're too strong, or if they're being exploited, as I would argue they are being exploited by national and international groups that don't really have Utahns' interests in their heart, then maybe there is room for some relaxation and you can still achieve that balance. You can improve overall quality of life through balanced recreation, development, things like that based on the needs and the wants of the people who live here.
So you're not saying that let's have a free-for-all for industry.
Certainly
you're saying
not.
It's proper to have regulation, but the local government can do a better job than
local and state.
Right.
I think state probably is where most of that should happen.
Sure.
For a lot of different reasons. I'm a Montana boy. I hunt, I fish, I ski, I do all those things, and I live here because of the view out your window right here. I don't want to see that change.
How do you respond to the question of who benefits here? Because clearly what you're hearing from critics is that industry benefit.
I think any policy change of this magnitude is going to see winners and losers. That's a simple fact of life, and that's why we have a political process to let those folks line up and have their say, and then decisions are going to be made. In some cases, industry is going to be winners. But if you look at the way that they modeled this, they looked at different parcels of land and types of land and made some assumptions that may or may not come true on how those types of lands would be used. So you would really have to say, industry is going to win in some cases, but there's also incredible opportunity for some set-asides. Under Utah has a Utah Wilderness Act, for example, where recreationalists and those who just want to have that view, which I fully understand, they may be the winners in this in some areas as well. So again, the key is to try to achieve that balance to improve overall quality of life for people in Utah or whatever other state this might be tried. And within that overall quality of life increase, there's going to be some increases and some decreases at an individual level.
Here's an email from Derek, who writes from Grantsville. As a hunter, I'm most worried about how Utah's control of public lands would result in what he calls the vast privatization of land in the state, with abundant public lands hunting opportunities. I wouldn't want to be out there hunting elk or deer under the kinds of land conditions hunters in states with vast private lands suffer. Here's his question to you. I wonder what Carl Graham's take would be on how much land privatization would take place if Utah takes control of federal lands. And this is a big question for people. Whether or not the state is going to get into a situation where it's not making any money, it's these vast deficits that they're having to deal with, and so they start selling off land.
Existing rights and traditional uses, like hunting, like access, like that, they've got to be respected. Grazers, folks with mineral rights, but also folks with traditional access. If you elk hunted with your grandfather in a piece of public land, you should be able to elk hunt with your grandson. That's got to be part of the process where those things are guaranteed. And I disagree, and I think this report backs up the contention that those lands will not have to be sold to pay the bills under most scenarios that this report looks at, and that's their general finding. And another finding of the report very specifically says that access to public lands, once they're state public lands instead of federal public lands, is likely to actually increase as trail restrictions are removed, as chains are taken off of motorized trail access in different areas and things like that. So my answer would be, I think your access is going to increase, not decrease under this proposal.
I want to get to the question of the legal question at play. Give me a sense of your sense of history, Utah in particular, but the West in general. When these territories became states, what was the relationship or what was the promise made by the federal government to the states related to the public land in their boundaries?
You know, it comes down to one word. What is the meaning of shall?
Of what?
Of shall. S-H-A-L-L.
Okay. It sounds like a Bill Clinton joke.
It does. I know.
Okay.
I tried not to go there, but thank you.
Okay.
In the Enabling Act, the contract between the territory and the United States government that created the state of Utah, and this is true of virtually every state and certainly every Western state, the Enabling Act, that territory forever disclaimed all right and title to open lands. And then there's a comma. Most people put a period there. But there's a comma, and it goes on to say, until such times as those lands shall be disposed of by the federal government. Is shall optional, or is shall a requirement and a half of a contract that one side, the federal government, has not performed on? That's the crux of the legal question.
Yeah.
That has never been tested.
What do you think?
I think shall means shall. I come from a Navy background. And
you mean get rid of that land. You need to dispose of that land.
You need to dispose.
That's what you think
it
says.
As happened in every state west or east of Colorado. North Dakota came in under the same enabling act as Montana, not the same day, the same piece of paper. North Dakota is about 3% federal land, Montana's 30% federal land. So that same requirement to dispose of that land, whether they used homesteading acts, railroad acts, Congress lands, all kinds of different ways that it was done, that wasn't done in the case of the Western states, and it should be done. But I would make a change. Times have changed. The requirements can change with those times. I would, as part of that disposal, I would rule out privatization, and I would say transfer it to the state to use, again, in a balanced way to maximize the quality of life of the residents.
I wanted to ask you about, and I know you've heard about this, legal scholars at the University of Utah have challenged the assertion that the
sure.
shall meant what you think it means. They mentioned the Constitution's Property Clause,
yes.
Which says, which grants, let me read it, which grants Congress an absolute right to decide upon the disposition of federal land, and no state legislature can interfere with this right or embarrass its exercise. Absolute is a pretty strong word.
It is, and I would not argue with that, obviously. I'm not a lawyer. But this isn't a demand to say – this is a demand that they exercise that power to dispose of those lands. It's not saying that the state should exercise that power. It's saying that Congress should exercise the power, as they promised to, in my opinion – to dispose of those lands. And there are constitutional scholars who have written articles in reputable constitutional journals, BYU's Law Journal, for example, that agree with that, or at least say that that is definitely a question that should be asked in the courts. And my question to people who don't want it to go to the courts, who say it's not worth arguing, is why not? If I was on that side and I was that confident that outcome was going to be that the states could not make that demand, I would want that in court tomorrow to get it decided and off the table.
I do want to get you on this question of royalties because it seems like a big one. Why would the feds give you 50%?
You know, in the early 30s, the federal government actually offered to give Western states the majority of that multiple-use land. But they only offered surface rights, not mineral rights. And the Western governors wisely they refused that offer because they recognized that all the costs of the land are on the surface and all of the revenues or potential revenues from the land, other than a few things like grazing and forests, are under the surface. And so they said, why would we take on all the costs with none of the revenues? So I would say as a condition of this, and this report again bears out the economic reason for this, but just as a matter of what's right, you would have to get those mineral rights along with the surface rights, which means you'd have 100% of the royalties. That would be a part of the demand.
So let me ask you finally, how long do you figure this would take? Because this is you yourself have conceded this is not a process that's going to turn around quickly.
Absolutely. This is it bothers me when I see terms like land grab or land seizure and things like that. It implies a bunch of people grubbing after it. No, this is a process, and this is going to take years. There's a political process. It'll take literally an act of Congress. To begin with, and then let the lawsuits start flying unless they're already flying, and it's going to end up in the Supreme Court. I think ultimately the Supreme Court is going to decide what the word shall means in this case, and I know that Congress is going to decide whether or not it's in the national interest to do this.
But you see enough light now, there enough possibility. This report now says the economics may line up. Legally, there's a question here for someone to resolve, some court to resolve.
Right.
So you must seem somewhat optimistic over time.
I am. I'm cautiously optimistic, as this report is cautiously optimistic, I would say. The other thing that gives me some optimism is that there are other states getting on board with this movement. Utah is way out ahead of everybody else, but there are at least half a dozen states in the West that will have legislation this year, either forming a task force or creating a study similar to Utah's study, or even making an outright demand like HB 148. You know, one state's kind of strange, two states might be interesting. You get half a dozen, six, eight, 10 Western states making similar demands. Congress has to pay attention and the courts have to pay attention to that and resolve it one way or the other.
Quick final question. The 31st is the deadline for this law for the federal government to trend. That's not going to happen, obviously. But do you have to sue? Does the state have to sue?
You know, that's for the state to decide.
Right.
There's a political strategy and a litigation strategy.
Right.
That's more of a political question, how they do that, and I'm going to let them figure that out.
Okay, good. Carl Graham directs the Sutherland Institute's Coalition for Self-Government in the West. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take another break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today on the program, we are talking about the idea of transferring public land, a good chunk of public land, 31 million acres of public land, to state control. It's an idea that Utah lawmakers are looking after, and there's been an exhaustive 700-page report that gave, at least from a lawmaker's perspective, gave them some sense that the state could, in fact, handle all of this. We've been talking about it, and we invite you to join us, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Joining us now on the program is Steve Block, the legal director and staff attorney for the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance, and thanks for coming in. Welcome.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you, Doug.
I want to back into this one with you. Let's start with the legal question and Carl Graham's impression of the Enabling Act, which comes down from his idea to one term, shall. Was there a promise made? Was there an intention with the federal government when these western states territories became states that they were supposed to get rid of all this public land and give it to the control of the states? What's your legal take on that?
Well, I think it's important to note that this question has already been asked and answered both by the United States Supreme Court and by the University of Utah, which did a lengthy study about the legality of the land grab legislation. And I mean, the answer quite simply is the state of Utah forever disclaimed its interest in these lands, and the Congress made no kind of promise that it would dispose of them, and certainly not to the states. I mean, the state of Utah has no claim to these lands. What we saw in some other states, in the eastern states, is that lands were disposed of from time to time and put into private hands, but never handed over to a state the way the state of Utah is arguing should happen here.
How are you reacting to the report that came out a week ago or so?
Well,
this exhaustive, massive report that said, hey, look, under these certain conditions, you could make a lot of money, the state, if this land somehow were to be transferred over, which is assuming a lot, but just your general reaction to it, the models and things.
Well, I think the report's a distraction. Hmm. I mean, at some level, as you heard from Brian earlier, if the stars align, and I think Carl said the same thing, if the stars align, it's possible that under one or two scenarios of continuous high prices of oil, if the United States hands over royalty money that actually belongs to all Americans,
That's a big assumption for you.
It sounds like a pretty big assumption to me. If a whole host of things happen, this could fly. But this is a state that prides itself on sound fiscal management. I mean, you hear the state of the state and Utah legislators very often highlight that, you know, we're the best managed state in the country. This sounds like a tremendous risk to head down this path, to hitch our star to the price of oil. And so I think the report's a distraction. I mean, I really come back to it's not about that. This is more about ideology than about reality. And it's about how do we maximize the development and the privatization of what are lands owned by the United States and managed on the behalf of all Americans by a number of federal agencies. I mean, we're not happy a lot of times with this federal agency management, and neither is the state. But there's a way to handle those, those arguments in court or through other avenues of civil discourse. And if we're serious, you know, for example, if we're serious about how do we make money for Utah school children, and when you listen to somebody like Ken Ivory, who's the sponsor of this bill, well, this law, you know, he raises that all the time. That this is about how do we get more money into the hands of our school children. Well, let's talk about things like why is there no severance tax on coal in this state when the state of Wyoming, which has a robust industry, has a 3.5 to 7 percent severance tax on coal. You know, why don't we raise the severance tax or the royalty rates for oil and gas? And of course, that's contemplated in the Transfer of Public Lands Act, but only after we get our hands on these federal lands. Well, let's try these things now. And let's see if we can, you know, have real answers instead of this sort of pie in the sky proposal.
You said it was ideological. Do you have a sense that more moderate factions within the ruling party, the Republican Party in this state, are as excited about it as people like Ken Ivory, for example?
My sense of it is no. I don't think they're – I mean, you know, this sells – you know, for the Tribune, it sells a copy. For the politicians, it's something that's very easy to rally around. It's a rallying cry that's always going to run well in the state of Utah, that the federal government is running roughshod over us and we should do something about it, darn it. But that's not serious. And that's not a way – I mean, it's not a serious approach to serious issues. And so I guess what we would – you know, focus on, for example, is the Public Lands Initiative, which is something that Rob Bishop is working on with a whole host of stakeholders. And that includes the counties and conservation groups. And it's a way to roll up your sleeves and sit around and say, how can we improve on the situation? How can we give more certainty to schools? How can we allow more access for hunting? And how can we protect the places that are so special in this state?
Does that worry you that... I guess maybe that's what you mean by a distraction, that if people think that there's a potential that this could happen, that they won't come to the table?
I think that's possible.
Does it worry you?
I think we see it play out from time to time.
Yeah.
I mean, I feel like it's a bit of an alter universe where this is – for some people, it's a question of when and not – if this is going to happen. And I think that's very dangerous. And, you know, you asked what do mainstream Republicans think about this, or Main Street. And I think it does worry them. And I think that's why you've seen every newspaper in the state of Utah in the past 7 to 10 days editorialize that this is a bad idea. And it's a bad idea in terms of financial management, and it's simply bad policy, and that it's a distraction.
You heard Carl Graham earlier talk about the fact that, look, I'm not interested in a free-for-all in terms of NEPA regulations or regulations related to land and antiquities and those kinds of things, but let's let the state impose their own kinds of regulations properly and responsibly, that he says. He says he trusts the state government over the federal government. What are your worries? This is a big hypothetical, of course, but let's say some sort of transfer did happen. What would happen to the Water Act, to NEPA federal regulations that you know have been nurtured and articulated over years and years?
Well, I think as you heard from Brian, I mean, it would be a bit of a free-for-all. The state of Utah simply does not have those sorts of rules and regulations or the case law for how to interpret them. You know, we've heard rumblings that the legislature will consider a state NEPA statute, but that has a long way to go. And, you know, we don't have to look too far. I mean, you have to look at the Utah Division of Oil, Gas, and Mining, and which has its own rules and regulations, or how are school trust lands managed, and they have their own rules and regulations. And they're simply not as strong as the federal system. They're just not. And I think that's a great leap that Carl was making to say that the state of Utah will put itself on par with the way, you know, federal lands are managed.
Let me take a call. 801-585-WEST is the number to join us. Larry's been waiting in Orem, Utah. Larry, welcome.
Thank you. The comment follows actually right up on what the guest was just talking about, and that is I am a Republican, but I have a fairly deep concern that within the state, however we would manage these lands, we run the risk of having a much more corruptible system by special interests here that would transfer the value of the lands into the hands of a few people than the federal government has been able would be. So I'm just concerned if we really have the public use mentality and integrity in Utah to maintain public use lands for the public, or whether we, and it's really our mantra in the state, or whether we are such a business friendly state that they're all going, that the value of those is going to flow from the public to the private sector in ways that deny our children and our grandchildren the same opportunities we have.
You're hearing a lot of that concern that now Brian Maffley mentioned earlier, this concern that county commissioners could be more influential in the process. There could be the potential for corruption in some cases. He didn't suggest that, but I'm guessing some would. This particular concern, you're hearing, you know, what happens to, you know, is this land going to be, there going to be more, no trespassing signs everywhere? If it doesn't work out, the state has to sell all of this. You want to respond to that?
Well, I think those are all very real concerns. I mean, what you heard from Brian, which is exactly right, which is that the in order to make money, this law incentivizes the development or the privatization of what are now public lands. And so it's either going to be that there's going to be the no entry sign, or there's going to be a more rapid pace of development. Or I think, like you heard from Carl, you know, the special places right now that are off limits for motorized use, for example, are going to be, you'll now see ATVs in those areas.
Are you worried about this? You say it's a distraction. It seems like you want to at least give me the sense that you're not at all worried about it, but it does seem that it is given some incentive to this movement that, according to Carl Graham, is going on throughout the West.
Well, I mean, I think...
And I'm talking about that report.
Yeah,
course.
Well, I mean, I do think it's a distraction. I think it takes away from the serious job at hand. I think it sets up Utah to fail if we're going to pursue this. If we're going to go through the courts, I think we're going to lose. We're going to spend a lot of money doing it. I think it's a distraction for how to solve real problems facing the state in terms of education funding. And as I said earlier, to the extent that the people who are serious, who are trying to solve these problems, think that they don't have to, since it's going to be taken care of for them through the legislation. Well, I suppose that's going to be a problem. I think ultimately, at the end of the day, this is going to dry up. This is it's another round of the sagebrush rebellion that we've seen time and time again. The Supreme Court has definitively said no to these things. I don't think the Congress is going to hand over for one state all of the magnificent lands and Red Rock landscapes that we have here in Utah.
That's Steve Block. He is the legal director and staff attorney for the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance. Thank you.
Sure. Thank you
very much for being with us. Let me get some final thoughts from Brian Maffley of the Salt Lake Tribune, who's been sitting here patiently waiting for us. So you're hearing both sides play out. Steve Block suggesting that this is more a distraction than anything else, not legally feasible, problematic, you know, financially for the state, who's very concerned about managing itself properly. You're hearing, you know, optimism from Carl Graham saying there's a movement going on, and now we have at least one report. There are others in the offing that suggest we can do this.
Yeah.
What do you make of it?
Well, the public land transfer law, I think, reflects this long history of frustration rural communities and the state has had with federal oversight of the land. It goes back before statehood, maybe, you know, 1850s. And what are the solutions here? So this is one of the solutions that one element in the Republican Party is pushing, taking over all this federal land. However, I think a lot of critics out there are saying, well, no, that's detracting from what a realistic solution, something like what Representative Rob Bishop is pursuing with his public lands initiative, other measures.
Which is compromise and bringing everyone to the table.
Yeah, it is very much a compromise. Everybody's got to give something up. in that in the public land transfer law, it's all about taking from the federal government and giving to the states. I see it as furthering conflict. If in fact this land transfer occurs, there'll still be a lot of fighting over what's going to happen on the public lands.
So your sense of what happens now, the Stewardship Commission is going to be looking at all of this in the coming months. They've got like $2 million that they set aside for all of this. It seems like they're pretty serious about going forward.
Well, absolutely. I mean, this is the official policy of the state to realize the goal of this law for Utah to own and manage the land. However, I think maybe there's other things that can be done to resolve these conflicts, and that might be, you know, reforming these laws that just seem to be such a problem. You know, this is a problem of our own, of the United States' own creating by establishing conflicting missions for the Bureau of Land Management. You have multiple use on the other hand, but oh, make sure you protect those archaeological resources and the groundwater and the little critters, and make sure everybody has a say in how these lands are used. Of course it's going to be difficult to manage those 23 million BLM acres. It's supposed to be difficult. And so now we have a law that's going to give these 23 million acres to the state of Utah. These are the BLM acres I'm referring to.
Yep.
And now it's just going to be magically a lot easier to have our way on those lands. I just don't see an organization like Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance or the Sierra Club or any of these other organizations interested in the health of the land just backing down. I just see more and more fighting.
It's Brian Maffley, covers public lands and the environment for the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks.
Thank you
very much. You can continue the conversation by going to our website, RadioWest at KUER.org. Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.